KCRW sponsors include Disney, presenting Young Woman and the Sea, an incredible true story from producer Jerry Bruckheimer and starring Daisy Ridley in select theaters Friday.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the last 2 months, local hotel workers represented by Unite Here, Local 11, have been at the bargaining table. They've been seeking raises and better benefits from hotel management.
We unite! We fight! We fight for water fight!
Their contract expires this Friday, and with no agreement in sight, more than 15,000 workers like housekeepers, dishwashers, cooks, wait staff in L.A. and Orange counties have been protesting. There was a big rally on Century Boulevard last week, and they could strike as soon as this weekend. And let's not forget, it would mean workers picketing, and no one would be cleaning hotel rooms at the start of the 4th of July holiday, which is one of the busiest travel times of the year. KCRW's Megan Jamerson has been following this. She joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Megan.
Hey, Steve.
What hotels are we talking about? Are these all the hotels? Is it just the hotels represented, you know, with the workers represented by this union?
It's hotels where workers are represented by this union. And so the union has been negotiating local contracts at some of the big name brands like Hyatt, Hilton, Marriott, all across LA and Orange counties, and also at luxury hotels like the Westin Bonaventure in downtown and the Beverly Wilshire in Beverly Hills.
And these are the same workers that demonstrated near LAX, right? Last Friday, there were hundreds of them gathered blocking Century Boulevard. Several elected officials were arrested too, right?
Yes, these are the same workers. And yes, LA City Council members Hugo Soto Martinez and Nithya Raman and Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo were among the 200 people that were arrested for not leaving the demonstration area after the LAPD told people to disperse. Now, the union told me that in a few cases, even multi-generational households of hotel workers were arrested last Friday. And in total, there were about 2,000 people there in support of workers, and people came as far away as Orange County. Now, those folks shut down Century Boulevard in both directions for hours near the airport, but it was otherwise described as peaceful. And I've been told that as of right now, there are no other actions planned this week.
What do the workers want? I mean, we know this is about pay and health care. I mean, specifically, though, do we know what they're demanding?
Yes, they are asking for raises. They're also asking for affordable family health care, a pension, and safe working conditions. The biggest sticking point, as you said, are those raises. So take housekeepers that are represented by Unite Here Local. They're making about $20 to $25 an hour here in LA. And so they want an immediate $5 an hour raise to that amount because they say they can't afford to live here in the city where they work. And the union told me that they estimate workers would need to make about $39.31 an hour to afford rent on an average two-bedroom apartment in LA. They also told me that these workers sacrificed a lot during the pandemic, and some even lost their lives, said Kurt Peterson. He is the co-president of Unite Here Local 11.
And meanwhile, workers are struggling to survive between inflation and housing costs. People just can't make it.
Workers really are struggling here. The union tells me that at the current hourly rate, more than half of their members can't afford to live in LA where they work. So they're moving further and further outside of the city and then commuting in.
So people are angry because the hotels, while they say they value them, you know, we want to see people want to see it actually in the wages and compensation and how they respect them.
Well, all right, how they respect them. What did the hotels have to say about this?
Well, by the time of this conversation with you, I did not hear back from any of the hotels involved in these negotiations. But I do know that Hyatt told the LA Times that they are bargaining with workers in good faith. And I also know that recently Hyatt reached an agreement in April with Unite Here Local 11 workers in Long Beach. And those workers got a $4 an hour raise. But back here in LA and Orange County, both sides are really far apart on contract terms. They are back at the bargaining table today, but I've been told that they don't have any more meetings scheduled this week before the contract expires at midnight on Friday. And it's also really worth noting that the last time that there was a strike with hotel workers, it lasted 2 months and it involved the same union. So they have a real track record of leveraging walkouts successfully.
A track record. So how did that play out?
So this happened in 2018, and it involved about 8,000 Marriott hotel workers in seven cities, including San Diego, San Francisco, Detroit, and Boston. Those workers walked out on the job for about 2 months. The hotels operated with limited room service, and several big conferences were rescheduled, which cost hotels big money. In the end, those workers won a $4 an hour raise and protections against sexual harassment. So if workers here in LA and OC walk out later this week, it would be the largest hotel worker strike since this 2018 action.
So, Megan, given that they're not negotiating between now and Friday when the contract expires, is a walkout imminent?
I think it's fair to say that there's a good chance that a walkout could happen as early as this weekend, unless hotels come back to the table and schedule a new meeting before Friday.
KCRW's Megan Jamerson reporting for us. Megan, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up, people from other countries make up more than a third of the population of LA County. So, how are immigrants doing here? There's a summit going on. It's looking at the policies affecting immigrants. More on that after this short break.
KCRW sponsors include Disney, presenting Young Woman and the Sea. This incredible true story from producer Jerry Bruckheimer stars Daisy Ridley as Trudy Ederle, who risked everything when she decided to swim the English Channel. The movie opens in select theaters Friday.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. There's a two-day summit going on today and tomorrow that brings together hundreds of nonprofit and government leaders to discuss what immigrant-inclusive policies look like in LA. Now, speakers for the Los Angeles Immigration Summit include Mayor Karen Bass, County Supervisor Hilda Solis, and City Council members Eunices Hernandez and Hugo Soto Martinez. They're talking about policies that affect more than 3.5 million immigrants in the county. That's about a third of the population, by the way, of L.A. County. And they're also discussing a new report from USC that dives into the key issues that affect immigrant Angelenos today. Manuel Pastor is here to discuss some of those issues with us. He's the director of USC's Equity Research Institute, which put together that report. Hi, Manuel.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Glad to have you. We're also joined by Odilia Romero. She's the director of Cielo, which is a nonprofit that works with indigenous communities here in LA. Odilia, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You bet. When we were talking, Manuel, about immigrant communities here in L.A. County, we're not talking, you know, just something monolithic. We're talking about people with very different cultural and language backgrounds, different religious backgrounds. How do you go about putting out a report titled The State of Immigrants in such a, you know, in such a diverse place?
Well, it's both a challenge and a delight because the population is very diverse, but it's also very large, you know. A third of LA County are immigrants, and about 60% of our children have at least one immigrant parent. So how immigrants do is actually going to determine not just the current state of Los Angeles County, but its future. We're also a county that's got quite a legacy of past immigration. You know, in the 1970s and 1980s, fully one quarter of all immigrants coming into the United States came into and settled in Los Angeles. So we've got a very long history here, and it's actually rapidly changing as well. Right now, Asian migration is outpacing migration from Latin America. There are many people who are refugees and asylum seekers who are arriving. There's tremendous diversity, which I know Theodelia will talk about with regard to indigenous folks coming from Central America and Mexico, whose first language may be an indigenous language and Spanish might be their second language. So there's one thing that people don't realize is about 20% of LA's black population is either immigrant themselves or the second generation U.S.-born kids of immigrants. So this is an issue that really touches all of us in Los Angeles County and in a very diverse way.
So let's talk about sort of a quick overview, quick, because, again, there are so many folks who are from other places. What is the overview? How are immigrants doing here in L.A. County?
Well, I think that the bottom line that I would share is that we've really made a lot of advances in terms of policy. We've got an Office of Immigrant Affairs, both at the city level and also at the county level. There's been, I think, pretty consistent attention, as well as at the state level, to open up public health services for immigrants. There's a lot of attention to making sure that lack of documentation status doesn't preclude you from being able to access some services you need. And recently, the county and the city have supported a defense fund, which is for immigrants who might be in deportation proceedings. Those are civil proceedings, so people don't get assigned a defender, to be able to access the resources to defend themselves and be able to stay in a country where they've established deep ties, have family members, etc. So we've made a lot of progress, I think, on the policy side. There are shortcomings. But I think that the big thing that we're trying to say is that immigrants are affected, like everyone else, by the housing crisis and overcrowding that has happened. They're affected by an economy that's underperforming and produces so many low-wage jobs. And immigrant communities have been especially hard hit by the COVID crisis and its aftermath. So we've got a lot to be proud of and to boast. We've got some real shortcomings. And then also the shortcomings affect all Angelenos. And one of the things we're really trying to lift up in this year's report is how tied the fortunes of immigrant Angelenos are to all Angelenos.
To all Angelenos, because we're all connected in one way or another, right? Whether, I mean, through jobs, through services, through the freeway system, through anything, you know, that we're obviously all a part of each other's lives in this county. Odelia, I want to bring you in here because you're the director of the nonprofit that works with indigenous communities, as Manuel has said. You're also a translator. What do you hear from the folks you work with about the biggest challenges that they're facing?
Well, the biggest challenge that we face is that there is an assumption that everybody that comes from south of the border speaks Spanish, not recognizing that in Mexico, there's 68 indigenous nations, and there's over 364 indigenous languages spoken in Mexico besides Spanish, right? So everywhere south of the border, there's an indigenous language spoken, and people fail to recognize that. So that is like the biggest challenge for people to recognize the diversity within Latin America when it comes to indigenous people and our languages.
The report found that more than a quarter of immigrant households, Odelia, are quote-unquote linguistically isolated. You know, undocumented immigrants are even more isolated, right? Because many of them don't know what to do. They don't speak the language. A lot of, you know, fearful of being tracked down. What does that mean, isolated?
Well, we are isolated as indigenous people. And I could say this, for example, if I am a victim of a crime and people don't know that I speak another languages, I might not be able to make that report. But also if I'm at a hospital and I'm trying to make educated, informed decisions about my health, my children's health, my family's health, if I don't have that information in my language, is a violation of human rights, right? For example, during the pandemic, there was no information in indigenous languages about what COVID was, how to take care of you. A lot of us work in the garment industry, in the restaurant industry. And during that time, so many people in our community lost their lives. You know, they were isolated from any information of what COVID was. We identified that there were 17 indigenous language families in LA County. That those are a lot of languages here, just indigenous from Mexico and Guatemala. Imagine, so many languages are spoken here and people that don't know that we speak other languages besides Spanish.
What can policymakers do then to make these spaces more accessible, more inclusive to immigrants? Is it just language? What else is it?
It's recognizing that we exist, right? But as you remember that embarrassing moment for city officials in October, how ill they spoke about Indigenous people and Black people, those are the people that implement policy. You could create a policy, but if it's not implemented, we still continue to contribute to the language violence against people that don't speak the dominant languages. So not only do we need the policy, we need implementation, we need funding, and we need to recognize the diversity of our city.
Manuel, you're actually moderating a conversation with leadership, with Mayor Karen Bass and other local leaders. It's called A Commitment to Immigrant Angelenos. What are you hoping to hear? What do you want to tell them? And what are you hoping to hear from them?
Well, I want to echo a bit of what Olivia is saying about recognizing the diversity of our immigrant communities. So there's the Indigenous community. It's very important to unpack the Asian American community because there are some groups that are doing relatively well, some groups that are faring poorly in terms of education and income. I think this is something that's important to the Black community, and you name it. So I think we actually have a 10-step program that we're presenting about producing more expansive and accurate data, which helps us think about digital equity, housing resources, and healthcare, looking at how immigrants are connected to all sorts of other issues like mental health, housing, the economy, addressing language access and cultural competency of the sort that Odilia was talking about, understanding that a lot of the community-based groups, Cielo was one of them, there were many others, stepped up during the pandemic to provide services to immigrant communities. How can we make sure that they are a long-lasting part of our implementation? And we've got a number of other recommendations about understanding diverse immigrant communities. So while we're going to be asking our public officials, Mayor Bass, Supervisor Solis, there'll be Councilwoman Juanisa Hernandez, and there'll be several others who will be there, is to be mindful of the diversity, be mindful of the contribution, and be mindful of what the county and the city can do to go through all of their services and ask the key question, where are these exclusionary? Where are these inclusionary? And what can we continue to do, not to just pat ourselves on the back about how we have a more welcoming attitude to immigrants than, for example, Texas or Florida, but how do we actually have not just a welcoming attitude, but a situation in which immigrants feel empowered to make change and immigrants are able to achieve their potential and their dreams.
Manuel Pastor, the director of USC's Equity Research Institute. Odilia Romero, the director of Cielo, which is a nonprofit that works with Indigenous communities here across LA. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, the fourth annual LA Immigration Summit runs through tomorrow. You can tune in to a live stream of the summit on the website for the California Community Foundation. We'll have the link at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. The original El Cholo restaurant, you know, the Mexican place on Western Avenue in Mid-City, it turns 100 this year. The LA institution first opened way back in 1923, and the dishes served up by waiters in white shirts and black ties trace the history of a changing city. From the green corn tamales on the restaurant's original menu to the nachos introduced in 1959 to the arrival of enchiladas suizas in 1978, Angelenos have long flocked to El Cholo, and of course they've expanded to other locations as well. Some have been dining there at the one on Western for decades and come for dinner several times a week. Well, Mona Holmes is a reporter for Eater LA and a regular here on GLA, and she celebrated El Cholo's centennial by getting to know some of the regulars there at the place on Western. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
At 100 years old, the original El Cholo is often talked about as one of the oldest, or maybe the oldest, existing Mexican restaurant in L.A. A little history here. It was opened by Rosa and Alejandro Borges in 1923, but it was opened under a different name, right?
Correct. At a different location, even.
Really?
Let me give you the details. Okay, so El Cholo was originally called Sonora Cafe. They named it after the Mexican state Sonora, where the Borges family was from. And it was near the Coliseum in Exposition Park. And it was positively tiny. It had 8 stools, 3 tables, but apparently everyone loved the food. So a few years later, in 1925, it's hard to believe that there wasn't a single Mexican restaurant in Los Angeles at the time.
I mean, amazing. That's what I was thinking as well. 1923, though, was a different time in L.A.
It was a different time and place. So people kept coming back again and again. They moved into a different storefront across the street from where they are now. And they were realizing that they were probably going to have to expand again. And while they were still in that space across the street from the original, there was a regular customer that came in. He was eating, and he drew a little cartoon almost like on a napkin, and it was a man wearing a sombrero, and he called it El Cholo. So when they moved across the street in 1931, they made a neon sign above the entrance using that same drawing, and they renamed the restaurant.
They named it El Cholo, Spanish cafe, right?
They did.
Yeah. What is the Spanish cafe part about? Because if it's a Mexican restaurant, we're not talking about Spain.
I know. And if you have a chance to read my colleague Farley Elliott's story about how restaurant owners back then had to figure out how to appeal to a public that had a negative view of anything labeled Mexican. And by negative, I mean racist. And then they also had to figure out how to earn a living. And so they called Mexican food Spanish.
Another superlative that the restaurant has claimed, in addition to oldest Mexican restaurant in L.A., is that El Cholo was the first restaurant to serve nachos. I mentioned that they started doing that in the 1950s. What's the story there?
There was a woman who has a granddaughter who is still living amongst us, and she told me the story of her mother, Carmen Rocha, who worked at El Cholo in 1959, and she's responsible for bringing nachos to Los Angeles. Now, the undisputed creator of nachos is Ignacio Anaya Garcia. He created them in 1943 in Texas, and Carmen worked for him, and she made them for customers just on her own. She would go in the back and prepare them for customers. She also made them for folks like Jack Nicholson and the Mamas and the Papas, Michelle Phillips, and people kept coming in and asking for them, even though they were an unofficial dish and not on the menu. And so one day they brought her in the kitchen to show them how, and the rest is history.
Jack Nicholson, you mentioned, was quoted in the LA Times obituary for Carmen Rocha, right?
Yeah, he was. From what Lisa Rocha told me about her grandmother, people like Jack Nicholson, Angelica Houston, all these famous folks knew and loved her well. Apparently she had their phone numbers and would call them and they would connect with her. It was a very personal relationship and friendship that they all had with one another. But I feel like that absolutely is the way that El Cholo operates. They make it personal. They really take care of their customers. They make you feel absolutely welcome and almost as if you're one of them.
You're one of them. And you mentioned the celebrities. You know, we talk about Jack Nicholson and Angelica and the rest of them. There are longtime regulars, though, that have been going to El Cholo for years, decades, right? Locals. And you got to know some of them while you were reporting this story. What did they tell you about the place?
Oh, they told me a lot of things. They told me that they kept coming back and pretty much ordering the same things. So this couple named Rosalinda and Marcos Borges, not related to the originators, they told me that they love the enchilada suizas. And they've been coming there for 25 years, and they get the exact same thing. Another customer named Will Free, he said that he'd been going to El Cholo for 40 years. And actually we can even address something that one person brought up to me, and you know, I won't mention their name, but they're saying, oh, I'm not a big fan of the food at El Cholo. And I said, you know, that's completely not the point here. What you're going for is the experience of being in El Cholo. El Cholo represents, this original location represents a time and a place in Los Angeles that is no longer. It has been there through many things. And so I think that people go back there to feel a certain way about this place that has witnessed the rise of this great city of Los Angeles. And they want a piece of that in the form of an enchilada or a taco or a burrito.
Mona Holmes from Eater LA, one of our regulars here at Greater LA. Mona, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow on this program, could artificial intelligence, AI, upend the voiceover community? Voice actors are uniquely vulnerable to exploitation from AI that can actually clone their voices. This is my actual voice, but, ooh, that's some scary stuff. Have a question, a thought, or a comment, maybe a story idea? Go to kcrw.com/GLA and get the podcast while you're there as well. Or you can get your podcast anywhere you get them by searching KCRW Greater LA. We'd love to be in your lineup. Juliana Mayo, Robin Estrin, Phil Richards, Michael Stark, Ray Guarna, Sonia Guy, Sammy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped with this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chitakis. Honored by your presence. Thanks for your time and attention. Have a great night.
KCRW sponsors include Disney, presenting Young Woman and the Sea, an incredible true story from producer Jerry Bruckheimer and starring Daisy Ridley, in select theaters Friday.